Welcome to Wealthion. I'm Wealthion founder Adam Taggart, welcoming you back for another weekly market recap featuring, as always, my good friend Lance Roberts. Hey, Lance, how you doing?
Hey, Adam, how are you?
Well, I'm feeling you're probably pretty glad you made it to the end of this week. Tell you, we like to kick these off with the theme of the week. I don't know if the theme of the week is there will be blood. Or duck and cover, yeah. Or hot, 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 to borrow from Buster Poindexter, referring, of course, to the new inflation number. So I imagine it's been a pretty rough week for you to get to the end to. How are you doing?
No, it's great. And actually, I was doing an interview today with Charles Payne on Fox Business. And, you know, he asked me a question. He said, what's your takeaway from the week, right? You know, what is this? And I said, it's really about lessons learned and relearned. And, you know, it was really interesting because last week, you and I were talking about, you know, hey, there's a lot of bullish things that are going on right now with the markets. We've got the markets breaking above the 50-day moving average, the 100-day moving average, took out the 20-day moving average on Friday. You had a 90% up day in the markets. We've had like four of those recently here. We have a lot of positive breath in the markets. And it's like, hey, we got a lot of bullish things going on here. And that kind of typically pretends, and we weren't really back to overbought levels yet. And I said, you know, that kind of really sets us up maybe for a bit more rally next week. Well, Monday was okay, right? No big deal on Monday. Tuesday, we get the CPI report, came in a little bit hotter than expected. And the market sold off 4% on a 99% down day. So, you know, what the lesson to learn from this, of course, is that you can have very nice bull rallies within a bear market, but the bears are still in control right now. And we can't forget that. So, you know, it's when we get into these situations, it's easy to kind of get drug off the sidelines. And we saw this, you know, we had that rally from July through August, 9 weeks of a bullish rally. And we had talked about, you know, previously here, you and I discussed that, you know, back when those markets were really, you know, down towards the lows in June and July, we were like, you know, we had massive negative sentiment. You know, the number of individual investors or sentiment was at levels we hadn't seen since the 2008 financial crisis. Everybody's bearish. And we said, you know, that's a good contrarian indicator and likely going to get a rally from this. And I said, what's really going to help that rally is when Jim Cramer starts pounding the table, you know, the bull market's back. And of course, he did that about 2 weeks before the market fell apart again.
Yeah.
So, you know, and that's kind of this is that cycle that we're in. And this market's going to most likely keep dragging people in, clubbing them in the head until they just quit coming back into the markets. And, you know, it was interesting this week because that 4% down, look, inflation was high. It was hotter than expected, but we already knew inflation was high. So it really didn't, you know, justify a 4% sell-off in the markets. But, you know, it also happened on a week where we had a $3.5 trillion options expiration, which is today on Friday. So, you know, we took a lot of that, you know, brunt of that selling pressure that was really kind of lined up for Friday, kind of just got drugged forward to Tuesday. So you had this very outsized sell-off on Tuesday and Wednesday. And then that kind of carried through Friday here. And of course, markets are still kind of struggling with it. Now, so that's all the bearish stuff. Here's the good news. Good news is that markets tend to rally following options expiration, right? Because all those positions that get liquidated, managers have to put them back on the books, you know, for the next quarter or whatever. So typically what we see is following an options expiration Friday, generally the markets can recover as much as 2 or 3% of that fall off over the next, you know, week or so. So, you know, there's a reasonable possibility here that we could, you know, markets are back to oversold again. And with this kind of real brunt of selling this week, you know, it wouldn't surprise me at all to see a bit of a rally next week. Now, use that rally, of course, to sell into, raise some cash, rebalance your portfolio accordingly. And just, you know, that's kind of been our advice, you know, for the last several weeks is to continue to do that. And that hasn't changed.
Okay. So, you know, you and I have talked on this program about the movie, The Revenant, which, you know, Leonardo DiCaprio movie where he famously gets mauled by this bear, right? This big grizzly bear. And you said it was pretty instructive for how bear markets work, because, you know, in that movie, the bear attacks him and just completely mauls him, and then it leaves, and, you know, you're watching him just realize that he's still alive, maybe about to die. But then, of course, the bear comes back again for even worse mauling. And you're like, that's kind of how bear markets work, until everybody just completely gets out of the forest and says, I'm never going anywhere near a stock again. So last week, you were saying, as you said, that it was really kind of a tricky time, because we had these cross currents where kind of everything on the macro side looked bad. There were some bad looking technicals as well, but there were a bunch of technicals that actually were bullish that you were talking about, you know, getting back to key levels like 50-day moving averages and stuff like that. So you were sort of, what I took away from last week's conversation was you saying, like, you know, this could kind of break either way, and it's you got to really, you know, be careful here. Yeah. Well, of course, it broke bad this week. Yeah. Does this give you more confidence that the bear market is on? And I hate using that term with you, because I know you've said many times, we're not technically in a bear market yet, because we're still in the bullish up channel if you go back far enough. But in terms of sort of 2022, you know,
the bearish mentality, yes, yeah. It's very much in play.
Okay. Is it this making the picture clearer to you?
Well, no, here's the, you know, and we talked about this before as well. And, you know, so, you know, there's Mike and I were just having a conversation today about this, because there's a very interesting situation that's developing in the markets. And there's a lot of companies out here that are in massive bear markets. There's a lot of companies. Companies all the way from Adobe to DocuSign to, you know, Zillow, all the way down to Federal Express and others. You take a look at those charts, these stocks are down, and we've talked about this before, is that, you know, there's a tremendous number of stocks that are down 30, 40, 50, 60, 70% from their 52-week highs, whether that occurred, you know, January of this year or their 52-week high was last year. But there's a lot of companies that have been decimated over the course of the last year or so. And there are some great opportunities that are starting to really kind of show up. We were doing a lot of work on FedEx today as an example. If FedEx, as an example, only has a 1% growth in cash flows over the next 5 years, that stock is undervalued on a lot of different metrics. But, you know, there's likely going to be some more pain for the stock short term. But I think there's going to be a really good opportunity to own that stock on the value side of the ledger longer term. I mean, we're not going to stop FedExing stuff to other people. I mean, you know, they may have a slowdown in shipments, but they're not going away. And that's the case for a lot of companies. But, you know, the indexes aren't even down 20%. And that's because of this passive indexing phenomenon that we've talked about before, that's shoveling money into Apple, Microsoft, Google, Netflix, you know, Meta. And it's keeping the market elevated, because out of every dollar that goes into the S&P 500, 30 cents of every dollar just goes into 10 stocks. The other 490 stocks in the S&P 500 have to battle over the remaining 60%. So, you know, that's that, you know, flow of money is really kind of distorting this whole bear market mentality. Now, if we ever get, and Mike asked me today, that, you know, here's the debate. He says, well, what if people start selling Apple and Microsoft? Yeah. Then what's going to happen?
And I said, and he asked you that, because that was my question to him in the Q&A earlier this week, the live Q&A he did with us.
Well, there you go. And so he asked me that question. I said, look, I said, two things are going to happen. I said, one, if people are dumping their ETFs, right, there's a bigger problem in the markets, right? And so now we're to the point where people are just dumping their ETFs. Apple, as an example, is in 350 some odd ETFs. I mean, it's just so, I mean, Apple is kind of like the core holding of every large cap ETF out there. So every dollar that goes into ETFs is just funneling into Apple. So if everybody starts dumping ETFs, that means we've got a bigger problem. We've got a Lehman moment in the economy or whatever it is. And people are now panic selling across the board. Now, that's not happened this year at all. There have been no outflows from ETF equities this year. Basically, I just posted a chart on Twitter a couple of days ago. I'll see if I can find it for you again, Adam. But, you know, what the show was is basically this whole year, there has not been any outflows of capital. People are not really that concerned about a bear market. They're still piling money into ETFs. They're still, you know, doing that work. And that's keeping this kind of lifted market, so to speak, you know, at this term. And underneath the surface, and, you know, we talked about before, it's like an iceberg. You know, what you see on the surface when you look at the market is you're looking at the top 10 stocks that are keeping the iceberg, you know, floating above the surface. Below that surface is a tremendous amount of devastation. So, you know, the issue is that, no, I don't think we're going to see a point to where we start seeing, you know, these massive outflows out of ETFs, because we've conditioned an entire generation to just funnel money into ETFs and, you know, buy the dip, and the Fed's going to pivot any moment. And this has been the argument now for the last couple of months, is like, oh, we're running up the market. Why? Because the Fed's going to pivot. No, they're not. Yeah, they are. And we're buying, you know, and money was going in July and August. We saw this rally, all based on this idea the Fed was going to pivot, but they're not going to pivot. And they've been very clear about they're not going to pivot. In fact, Jerome Powell, what everybody overlooked at the Jackson Hole Summit was Jerome Powell was very clear. He says, I'm okay with below trend economic growth. Below trend economic growth is less than 2% growth. And that is not supportive of valuations at 30 times earnings or earnings growth at $220 or $230 a share into 2023. That ain't going to happen with below trend economic growth. So this market has not caught up with where the Fed is scheduled to move in order to bring inflation down to levels they are comfortable with. And so to your question, that's a really long-winded way to get to your question, which is, you know, do I think the bear market's still intact? Yeah, you know, the bearish trend of asset prices are definitely in play. We could be in a really big trading range for a while, somewhere between 3,800 and 4,200, somewhere in there. We're oversold enough now. We have another big rally. It's going to suck people back in again. Then we break down and go lower. And I think that's going to be that process. And once we get into 2023, I think that's where your recession is. And then that's where potentially you get, you know, even lower lows at some point.
Okay. Okay. I've got so much to get to based upon what you just said, which is great. Before I do, I'm just going to ask my question a slightly different way to get just a quick answer from you. But, you know, last week it was sort of like we were peering into the mist and we could see the shape of something, but we just couldn't really make sure out whether it was a bull or whether it's a bear. Does it look a lot more like a bear to you this week?
Yeah, it's a lot more like a bear this week. Okay. From a technical perspective, so we talked about last week is that we had these rising bottoms from the July low. So we had this kind of this rising bullish trend line. We took that out this week. So what was what we thought was kind of a bull in the mist there turned out to be a bear.
A bear and a bear with some horns on. Okay, so like some Groucho Marx horns.
A bear eating a bull. I don't know what was going on. Anyway.
All right. Well, and just to go back to something you said earlier too, I think it was 2 weeks ago, you know, you had said, hey, look, let's not mince, you know, words here. There are no fundamental bull arguments right now. You know, yeah. All the bull arguments right now are technical. It seems like a lot of the technical bull arguments might have just gotten invalidated, at least in the short term. Okay, so I want to go to what maybe possibly could eventually result in outflows from equities, which might trigger what you were just talking about there. Real quick before I do, I just want to address two quick things. One. Folks, if you enjoy watching these videos and you haven't yet subscribed to this channel, please hit the subscribe button. And if you are a subscriber, check to make sure you're still subscribed. And I just say this because I get notes from folks from time to time saying, hey, you know, I subscribe to your channel. I click that little bell next to the subscribe button. And for some reason, it's unchecked now on YouTube. And I missed the alert for your latest video. So I just want to make sure that everybody is getting their best opportunity to, you know, get alerted when we're putting new content out here, especially these weekly market recaps. So if you can just take a quick second, look down at the subscribe button. If it's not checked, click it, and then obviously click that little bell icon right next to it. The second item, and I'll talk more about this at the end, but I just want to remind folks that Wealthion's annual fall online conference is now just a week away. And so if you've been waiting to register for it, don't procrastinate any longer because you're going to miss out. And tonight, at midnight tonight, the last 15%, last chance to save price discount will expire. So if you're planning on going to the conference, and to be honest, everything that's been going on this week that Lance and I are talking about is exactly why you want to go to the conference, because we've got a ton of experts there, including Lance, talking about, you know, their recommendations on what to do going forward, given where we're headed. So to register for the conference and claim that price discount before midnight tonight, go to wealthion.com/conference. Okay. Now, so Lance, you talked about FedEx, right?
Yeah.
So for folks who don't know, FedEx came out and reported really just tremendously poor earnings and revenues, given expectations, and they got clobbered. I believe it's actually the largest plunge ever for the stock after an earnings. And they ended up withdrawing their fiscal 2023 earnings forecast, right? So they basically said, okay, you know, we were giving guidance, we're pulling that guidance away right now. And then in a follow-up interview today, this is why this is so important. So the CEO, Raj Subramaniam, I'm probably murdering his last name there, but basically he admitted that he sees that we're going into a worldwide recession. And of course, that's important coming from FedEx, because FedEx, they've got a front row seat. They're the guys that are actually, you know, moving the blood vessels around the circulatory system of the global economy, right? So in his own words, he says, we're a reflection of everybody else's business, especially the high value economy in the world. So, you know, hearing that from this guy basically saying, look, I'm the guy who's actually making stuff move, and I see us going into a global recession. That is a big statement. I'll let you react to that, but there's some sort of cascading data from that. Anything else you want to say about FedEx and its recession?
I think you're being polite about the statement. Not only did they poop the bed, they pooped the closet, the living room, the kitchen. it was the worst possible. I mean, normally CEOs try to, you know, tailor their statement a bit, you know, saying, okay, look, this is a really bad number, but there, you know, there's some positive silver linings. They didn't even try. They were just like, it's so bad, we're just going to hit you with it now. But that's part of that is that reason why I think now is a good time to start looking at FedEx, because, you know, the stock was down 20% today, but the stock was already down substantially going into this earnings announcement. So, you know, the amount of market cap cut off of FedEx today is probably overpriced in even what they were talking about. It doesn't mean there's not some more downside risk. You know, a lot of people are trapped into the stock now. They're going to try to sell on a rally. This thing's going to take some while to kind of work out. But, you know, there's a couple of things to be thinking about. And here's some questions that I do not have answers to yet, but I think they're interesting to talk about, is that one, FedEx is looking at their business and they're going, okay, we're seeing this massive slowdown in the business. So, you know, here's my business where it was, here's where it is now. And if this is the case, that means the whole global economy that we deal with is going to be slowing down tremendously and we're going to have this recession. And he's right about that, by the way. That's a fair and accurate statement. Europe is in a really tough spot here between their energy cost and what's happening with the war and just the general economy in general. And then, of course, you know, they're a big dependent on the U.S. as well. So as our economy slows down, 40% of our corporate profits come from what we sell internationally. So between a strong dollar and what's happening in the economy domestically, people are going to start buying less from overseas. So yeah, they've got real problems, and a recession on a global basis, certainly well within the context of things. But here's something else to think about, though, on top of this. And again, don't have the answer to this, but this is what I'm looking for. You know, Amazon's been making inroads into the shipping business as well. Have they started eating into FedEx's margin share of the business? Did UPS? UPS was down in sympathy today with FedEx. Is UPS eating into some of FedEx's business? Those are the things that we also want to try to evaluate, right, and understand, is that before we say, you know, here's FedEx and here's the global economy and there's the direct linkage, and there is, but are they also losing market share to competitors? And that's also going to be an impact on their business that may not necessarily represent such a big decline in the global economy. Again, I'm not saying one way or the other, but I think they're interesting questions to ask and explore.
Right. And actually both may be true, right?
Yeah.
And you know, I think I've told you my neighbor works for Rivian, which is the new sort of electric truck startup company.
Right.
And they have a massive deal with Amazon to supply Amazon with this electrified delivery truck fleet. And so, you know, I mean, we're all familiar with, you know, all these folks that are showing up our doorstep and, you know, US Postal Service trucks or, you know, random other delivery things all coming, delivering our Amazon packages. You know, as Amazon continues to, you know, make inroads there, it probably is taking a material amount of business away from FedEx and UPS. Okay. But here's where I was going with this.
I don't know about you, Adam, but, my wife's on a first name basis with the Amazon guy. He brings her birthday presents. So, you know,
okay. Well, at least somebody's buying her birthday presents.
Exactly.
All right. So, building on this, so FreightWaves, which tracks the transportation industry, they just noted that imports through Los Angeles to the Port of LA, which is America's largest port, they plunged 17% in August, right? So it's another bit of corroborating data that there's this slowdown going on, right? At least in terms of things moving from point A to point B. So here's where I'm going with this. The VIX, given, you know, the battering that the markets have had over the past couple of weeks, the VIX really is still pretty low, right? It's still below 30, right? And you know, for folks that don't know what the VIX is, it's the volatility index. Some people call it the fear index, but it's pretty inversely correlated to how the markets move. And when the markets really move big, and they had their biggest down day in 2.5 years, you know, a few days ago, the VIX isn't moving very much on that. And that's definitely interesting. And I'm going to let Lance give his opinion on that in just a minute. But here's where I'm going with all this, Lance. So Nicholas Colas, who's the head economist at Datatrek, he put out an article that I retweeted this morning saying that he just thinks it's too low at this point to signify that we're near any sort of market bottom. And he feels that he says the worst case scenario is that it reflects the beginning of a slow grind lower for corporate earnings, right? And, you know, FedEx just took away their forward guidance. You and I have talked many times on this program that a big shoe to drop here is that forward earning estimates have to come down. They are still ridiculously rosy, I think, in most sane people's opinion, for even the end of this year, but certainly in 2023. And mathematically, you bring down earnings projections, stocks are supposed to be based on a multiple of earnings, stock prices are going to have to come down further too. So are we finally at the point where analysts are going to be forced to bring, because companies are bringing them down. FedEx just did it.
Yeah, no, the analysts are way behind the curve here. And I've been writing articles about this and we'll talk about the VIX here in a second too, because I'm actually covering that in this weekend's newsletter at the website. So if you go to realinvestmentadvice.com and click on our newsletter link, you'll this Saturday, the newsletter will be up. But if you subscribe, I'll email it to you. You know, here's the thing though, is that, you know, I've been talking about this for a while. So earlier this year, analyst estimates were actually rising going into 2022, 2023. In June of this year, estimates were still rising. Despite the fact we were already down 15, 16, 17, 18% in the markets, estimates for analysts were still going up into 2023. Finally, in July, analysts woke up and go, wait, maybe we're a little overly optimistic. And finally, they started bringing those down. But we're nowhere near where we should be. You know, earnings, you know, we have to go back to just some basic fundamentals of life in the markets, which is, you know, again, as I said earlier, Jerome Powell said, I'm okay with below trend economic growth. Don't dismiss that statement, because that's so important to the market outlook and for earnings as well. Earnings come from economic growth. Period, right? It's what you buy in the economy. It's what Adam buys. And when we go buy stuff from Amazon and have it shipped to our house, that's where earnings come from. Earnings just don't magically appear out of some fantasy that, you know, is going to happen here. There has to be an activity. Something happens at the top line to create a dollar's worth of income that filters down into your earnings after expenses and, you know, earnings before interest, depreciation, taxes, amortization. That gets you down into your earnings per share. And then we manipulate that bottom number with all kinds of write-offs and stock buybacks and everything else to try to get this EPS number to beat, you know, Wall Street estimates. But those estimates are still multiples of deviations above where the economy is going to be next year. So, you know, right now we're at 220, 230 $220 to $230 a share in earnings, depending on who you look at, Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, et cetera. But just to get down to the median trend line, long-term exponential trend line for earnings, you're talking about $180 a share. And you're not going to potentially just go to the median and stop. So there's a real risk if we get into an earnings, into a recessionary economy. If FedEx is right and we have a recessionary economy in 2023, which I think is a really good possibility because of what the Fed is doing, right? They're going to break something eventually, just a function of time. Right. That we're probably talking somewhere that earnings could be somewhere between 120 to 140 a share. And if prices just stay where they are now, you're talking about multiples on the S&P of 35 to 40 times earnings. So, you know, we're still, you know, the P's come down a little bit. The E has not in valuations. We're still very elevated in the markets. And forward, and by the way, let me just say something about forward earnings, because this is where, you know, you hear a lot of analyst estimates. So, well, based on forward earnings estimates, you know, stocks are cheap right now. You need to stop using forward earnings estimates for any type of analysis, because it is complete bullshit. And there's no other word for it. I mean, I'm sorry, you know, if we're supposed to have a PG type, you know, podcast, but there's no other word to properly describe forward earnings, because it's earnings as I wish they would be. And that means that, you know, I'm saying that my earnings in 2023, before I pay taxes and you know, pay employee expenses and any other bad environment, inflation, whatever comes in, that's what I think my number might be. That is nowhere near reality. But let's just assume for a second that you're buying stocks today, right? I just saw this article out yesterday. Stocks are cheap based on forward valuations. Forward valuations on the S&P are like 14 to 15 times earnings based on forward earnings. Okay, great. So that's cheap. I'm going to go out. I'm going to load up my portfolio full of stocks. And then you find out that earnings aren't $230 a share. They're $180.
Right.
Now, all of a sudden, that forward earnings isn't so cheap anymore. That valuation you thought you were paying 15 times earnings for is now 30 times earnings. And now you're down 40 to 50% in your portfolio. So stop using that forward earnings analysis, because it's complete bogus. The only thing that matters at the end of the day is, and again, when you look back historically, we talk about valuations, that's after. Those are real earnings, and that's what's reported earnings. That's what we know happened, you know, on a trailing basis. That's the only valuation measure you should ever use in managing your money.
Yeah, the problem is Wall Street doesn't.
Because you couldn't sell anything.
Well, exactly. And maybe let's clarify for people here that don't work in Wall Street, you know, what's going on here, right? So forward earnings is an incredibly biased number, and it's biased at least for two big reasons. One is it's what management wants you to believe it is, right? And so to Lance's point, you know, if you know a CEO, they are super optimistic by nature, and they want you to think that the company is going to the moon, right? So they are going to sell you the brightest sunshine that they can, right? So it starts with the number that the company gives to the analysts, right? And then it's analysts' job to say, okay, you know, is this company forecast number, you know, is it realistic? And they supposedly go and build their models and, you know, do all their black magic to come up with what they think it truly is. The problem is that these analysts work for the same investment banks that are underwriting, you know, these companies' capital raises, right? And so there's a tremendous amount of pressure from the top management in these investment banks, you know, on the researchers. Technically, there's supposed to be a Chinese wall where the researcher is super separate and independent. But it's just sort of like the way the Fed is independent, right? You know, it's very clear the message that the research analysts get that, you know, hey, you know, whatever number you come up with, it's still got to be one that management isn't upset about at our client. And it better not have anything other than a buy rating along with it, right? I mean, you know better than I, Lance. I mean, when we have these turns in the market, I mean, usually still like, you know, the buy to sell ratio in terms of real estate, in terms of research analyst recommendations, it's like greater than 9 to 1, right?
That's right. No, and you know the issue, and to your point, you know the analyst, you know, don't have any real, you know, any compunction that they work for the retail investor, right? If there's been numerous, kind of articles out. In fact, I wrote one on our website. So if you go to realinvestmentadvice.com and you type the word truth into the search bar at top, you'll come up with an article called The Truth About Wall Street Analysts. And what it goes through is it talks about why, you know, there's always a buy rating out of, out of the 5,000 issues that are publicly traded on the market, have analysts following them, 4,000 of them have a buy rating. You know, the number of stocks that have a sell rating is like 100. And the reason is if you rank a stock a sell, the company that you're doing the investment banking deal with don't want to use you. They'll go to somebody, they'll give them a buy rating. So that's where the investment banking business goes, which is where the real money is. It's not, in trading stocks all day. But there was a really interesting article in the Wall Street Journal, and it said, and it surveyed analysts, and it asked them, it says, how important are the following to you regarding your compensation? And number one was your industry knowledge, followed by your standing in the analyst ratings, followed by professional integrity. And all the way down the list was the accuracy and timeliness of your earnings forecast. And it had the least impact on their compensation. So then they ask them, well, okay, if that's the case, how important are the following clients to your employer? Number one was hedge funds, two, mutual funds, three, defined benefit pension plans, four was insurance firms, five was endowments, six were high net worth individuals. You know what the bottom of the list was? Retail investors.
Retail investors, yeah.
You know how important they were? The average rating was 1.5%.
Wow.
So the point is, and again, if you're interested in reading the whole article, go to realinvestmentadvice.com, just type the word truth in the search bar at the top of the page, and it'll come up with the article. It's called The Truth About Wall Street Analysis. And it goes through this, but the point about this is that, you've got to be really careful about what you take away from supposed Wall Street, people, right? Wall Street is a massive multi-billion dollar business every year. They make billions of dollars worth of revenue. Wall Street is not in the business. They don't care about you. They don't care about your money. They don't care about your retirement. Their job is solely one thing, to sell you product. Do you think Target cares about your personal financial situation at home? No, they want you to go in the store and they put everything nice on the shelves so that you always go in and buy 1,200% more than you actually needed when you went in. Go in for a roll of toilet paper, you come out with a $500 bill. That's what Target does, right? And there's nothing wrong with that. It's a business. Wall Street doesn't care about you. They don't care about your financial future. Their goal is to sell you product. And this is what we saw in particular during 2020, 2021 is a great example of this. They couldn't get IPOs out the door fast enough to fill the need of demand from individuals that were trying to buy startup companies. So they switched over to SPACs, these special purpose acquisition companies, where they could basically raise capital, have no business, right?
No clue what to do with it.
No clue what to do, but give me your money and I'll go find something to do with it. That's how, because they couldn't get the company to public, through an IPO fast enough, right? So there was this big demand for product.
Or at all, or it might not have made it through the official, it might have gotten rejected, but hey, here's a way to skirt that, right?
Exactly. And that happened. I mean, there were a lot of SPACs that didn't turn out well, but this is the point. When there's a lot of demand for something, Wall Street's going to make sure you have it. Doesn't mean it's good product, right? Doesn't mean it's good product at all. It's Nike with 3Ks. you'll get a shoe, but it's not a Nike. It's a Nike.
Nike with a Y in the end. Yeah, exactly.
But that's what's going to happen. That's what happens. And, and this is the important thing you've got to remember is that when you're investing your capital, the only person to look out for you is you. And, this is one thing that, I love with the firm I work with Connie and Danny and Richard Rosso and Michael Leibowitz. They're all very dedicated to doing the right thing for our customers, right? And their needs come first. And that's a real rare thing to find, in the world today. But when you're talking about Wall Street, they are wolves in sheep's clothing. They are not out looking for you. So be careful what you take away from Wall Street analysts and ratings. This stock's rated to buy, I should buy it. No. it's probably not a buy rated stock. You should really probably do a little bit more work on it.
So agree with everything you said, except I'm gonna disagree on how you kind of compared Target to the investment banks, because I do think that's unfair to Target. No, because I mean,
well, I was trying to come up with an example of somebody that sells product off the top.
But what I mean by that is you know, Target, yeah, they're going to merchandise to you and try to sell you as much stuff as they can. But they say, look, you need a mop, come to Target. We'll sell you a mop, right? And they sell you a mop. The promise of these big firms is, hey, we're going to look out for your wealth, the future of your wealth, right? That's a failed promise, right? All they want to do is tell you whatever it takes to get your money, to get more of your money, right? So they are not the wealth stewards that they market themselves to be. And again, for folks that don't know, the reason why I at least have some credibility to talk about this is that's where I started my career. So right out of undergrad, guy who knew absolutely nothing about the financial world, I ended up getting into one of these financial analyst programs on Wall Street. And I worked for a big name investment bank. I won't mention it, but you can go look at my bio and see it. It's a big, big investment bank.
Yeah, Goldman Sachs.
It wasn't them. It wasn't the squid. But what's so funny is I remember, you know, they put you through this intense training a couple of weeks. You show up, you go through like 2 or 3 weeks of intense training in a classroom. They have all these experts come in, and then you go to the department you're going to work for. And during that training session, they have somebody come in from like the compliance department or whatever, and they beat into your head, oh, you know, we have this Chinese wall between research and investment banking, and man, you know, no, they should never talk to each other. It's sacrosanct that, you know, research has to be left alone to do, you know, what they think is right for the customer. And I remember like the first week in our office, one of the research analysts called one of the investment banking analysts that I work with, and he just was petrified. He was like, he hung up the phone and was like, went to his boss and was like, this guy called me. I don't think I can talk to him. I mean, what am I going to do? Right. This guy's crossing the Chinese wall. And his boss was like, you should call him back, answer whatever he wants. And I can't tell you how many trips I had to make personally back and forth from my floor in investment banking down to research to carry information back and forth between the two. And at that time, I just thought it was just sort of the way things worked and it was inner working of the bank. But of course, with the benefit of hindsight, I was just sort of like, oh my God, you know, like the it's exactly the opposite the way that it's being marketed. I mean, they're so enmeshed, and I won't rehash everything you just said there, Lance, but I mean, I can tell you folks from firsthand witnessing that is a symbiosis as opposed to the separate and distinct columns that they're supposed to be. Just the last one more thing on what you mentioned there, Lance, which is for people watching and saying, well, I mean, what do we do then, right? Who can we trust? It's obviously why we created Wealthion and why we put our brand at risk to endorse guys like you, Lance. But what I want to say to folks watching is yes, you want to find it. We think you should work with a financial advisor, you know, unless you're a professional money manager yourself, guessing few you are. Yes, you want one that's good and smart and understands all the macro stuff that we talk about here. To me, those should just be like table stakes. Those just should be part of your filter. What your job really is as an individual, if you're going to entrust somebody with the management of your wealth, is you don't need to be a stock picker. You need to be an advisor picker, right? So your job is to really do your diligence in terms of, hey, is this somebody who's got integrity, who's got a good track record, who thinks the way that I do, who's, you know, going to give me good customer service, who's, you know, going to tell it to me straight, whether it's good, whether it's bad, and it's going to have my interests at heart. That's really what your priority should be here, as opposed to like, what's the best stock I should buy next, right? So at the end of the day, I don't care who you work with. We have the guys that we offer here through Wealthion because we think they're good and we've got enough history with them to feel good about that. If you find somebody else you like better, that's great, but just don't fool yourself. Your job right here is to find the right advisor for you. You get that right, everything else should filter out from that.
Yeah, let me say something about that too, because it's a great point. And you know, one thing is like when you're going to talk to an advisor, you know, it's almost like talking to a priest in a lot of ways. Don't lie to the advisor, right? And you know what I mean by that is you know, don't kind of hide the truth or, you know, try to manipulate the truth to get an answer that you want. you know, one of the biggest challenges that we have with individuals that we meet with is the individuals come in and they say, oh, you know, I don't want to lose any money. I want to be really conservative because I just, you know, if I could just get 2% a year, you know, I'm actually good with that. And then as soon as the market runs up, they're like, well, why don't we have more risk? Right. You know,
I talked to my brother-in-law at a party. He's got the stock that's going crazy. Why am I not in that?
Yeah. Exactly. Right. So, you know, be honest about what you really want and what you're trying, what your goals really are. And this is why, you know, we did this financial planning seminar, you know, with you, Adam, a couple of weeks ago. But we do really in-depth, you know, work on that financial planning side to try to drag out the real truth, right? Because everybody comes in, they tell us one thing. You know, there's all these questionnaires that people fill out, and they're always very interesting from a psychological perspective, because during a raging bull market, you know, these questionnaires I'm talking about, they go, here, you know, complete our risk profile questionnaire. And during a raging bull market, it said one of the questions is always, well, if you lose 10% in your portfolio, what would you do? A, sell everything. B, you know, buy more. C, do nothing. You know, D, put more money to work, right? You know, whatever they are. Well, during a bull market, everybody says, oh, buy more. In a bear market, everybody marks sell everything.
Right.
So, you know, it's important that you really come back to, you know, to your basis and be honest about it. Because if you're interviewing an advisor and the advisor is saying, look, okay, I'll just tell you from our standpoint, we're very conservative. Our job is to grow money over time and minimize drawdowns and get gains when markets are going. That means, and by doing that, we're going to not perform as much on the upside. If markets are up 20, we're going to be up 14, 15. If markets are down 10, we're going to be down 4 or 5, you know, but that's the way we work. So if you're coming in going, that's what I want, but in reality, you want to chase the market, we're not a good advisor for you. You're not gonna be happy with us long term. And you know, we want to have a really good relationship with our clients. And so when you're shopping for an advisor, just be as honest as you can about it. And look, most advisors are gonna tell you, like, no matter what you tell them, they're gonna go, oh yeah, yeah, you'll be great. We'll put you right in. Right.
Yep.
But you know, we reject a lot of people because, you know, if you're not gonna fit within our demographic of how we work, we don't want you to be unhappy, because if you're unhappy with us, you leave, then you tell other people that you weren't happy with us. And that's not good for our reputation, right? So we want to make sure you're happy. We want to, you know, we do a lot of work on the customer service side, lots of communication, lots of touch and feel to make sure that, you know, we keep this kind of this relationship built over time. But the biggest challenge is always matching up what people tell us they want versus what they really want. And unfortunately, we don't normally find out the differences between those two things until you get right into the heat of the market somewhere.
Right. Oh, very well put. You know, like many things in life, I guess it's sort of a garbage in, garbage out, right? If you're not being upfront or honest with yourself, let alone the advisor, you're probably not going to get the results you want. Okay, I got a number of things I want us to crunch through, including trades that you guys may be making given what's happened this week in the markets. Real quick though, and this is another kind of big idea. So treasury rates are now getting up there, right?
Yep.
So for many, many years, everybody said, Tina, there is no alternative. You got to be in stocks because you can't get a return anywhere else. Well, now all of a sudden, you know, people are saying, hey, those returns aren't so bad. And yeah, inflation's still high, but hopefully inflation comes down at some point. But, you know, when compared to dividend rates on stocks, mm-hmm. all of a sudden, treasury is looking pretty good. Nick Jurley, who speaking at the conference, real estate expert analyst, he just put out a tweet the other day saying, hey, when you look at where cap rates are going, they're coming down. And that's sort of a measure of return for housing. And you look where treasuries are going. And he was just looking at, I think, the 6-month T-bill, I mean, a short-term treasury. They're not that far apart at this point. And he was saying, like, hey, you know, like, what would you rather be? A landlord with all the hassles that come along with it and maybe staring at a, you know, a 10 to 30% correction in the housing market nationally? Or would you rather just sit back in a T-bill and just kick it back and earn the same amount with less risk, right? I mean, all of a sudden, and this goes to the question about, could this be one of those things that starts sucking capital out of the equity market? Because all of a sudden you can get a much quote unquote safer return in at least U.S. government backed bonds, let alone not necessarily talking about corporate bonds.
No, it's very true. First of all, it likely will. You know, for the first time where you can go put money in a 2-year treasury and pick up nearly 4%, makes a lot of sense, right?
And so I hate to say this, but your buddy Jim Cramer was just telling people that that's what he's doing now.
Yeah. And there's nothing wrong with that, right?
There's nothing wrong with it. It's just anything he does that I might be doing just makes me feel a little skeevy.
Yeah, no, well, and also he's not my buddy. But other than that, here's the thing. So, you know, this is what always happens. And this is going to happen again, is that, you know, when you're in the midst of a bear market, and this is exactly what's going on right now. And, you know, as the Fed's hiking rate, these treasury rates come up. So everybody goes, well, why take the risk in stocks? I'll just go buy treasuries. Awesome. Nothing wrong with that. And I just had this email conversation with a guy yesterday. I said, this is fine. Sell all your equities, move them into 2-year treasuries. Awesome. Now you're locked up in your treasury for 2 years. When are you going to get back into equities? And, you know, so part of this reality is that if you're going to move a bunch of money into treasuries, that's fine. I got no problem with it. We just added to our treasury position a couple of weeks ago. We talked about that last week. But when are you going to get back into equities? Because somewhere in here within the next 12 to 18 months, we will have the bottom of the market. And then the returns out of the market are going to be much greater than what you've got on your 2-year treasury. So now you're selling your treasuries to try to jump back into the equity markets, but maybe you're early, right? So this is always that, you know, that trade-off that we try to make by timing markets. And as always is the case, you know, individual investors really never get it right. You know, they're either late, they're early, they just wind up making repetitively bad decisions. I've got no problem with it. You know, I had this conversation on a radio show just, you know, last week. I said, look, you know, if I could get, you know, we have clients come in all the time. It's like, I just need 4% of my money. If I just had 4% of my money, then, you know, what else do I need? Right? I'm good. Okay. Buy a treasury. You can get 3.5% on a 10-year right now. Hold it for 10 years. You got 3.5% return, no downside risk. May make some money if yields come back. If yields come back down, you'll make some money on the capital appreciation side. But the reality is that it sounds great at the moment, but as soon as equities start ripping off the bottom, then you're going, well, why am I in these bonds yielding this crappy 4% when the markets are yielding 8, 9, 10%, right? So now you're selling these stocks, selling your bonds to go buy, you know, stocks at a more expensive valuation. You know, this is why, you know, these things never work out well over time, but should be part of your overall allocation. This is why in our portfolios, we own treasuries, right? You know, we see yields coming up. We've been buying a lot of corporate bonds lately that are yielding 4, 4.5, 5% over the next 2 years, but we still have our equity exposure as well. And we still hold a lot of cash because it should be part of your allocation. But the problem with being all in or all out of one asset class, we've talked about the risk of one side.
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah.
You know, it sounds great in theory until it goes in the other direction. And what I mean by the other direction is now all of a sudden a 4% yield isn't nearly as lucrative as what the stock market's going to give you. And we're going to get to that point. We're just not there yet. So just something to think about.
Yeah. So just to press on that for a tiny bit, and I'm not pushing anything here. I'm just thinking through this and hearing what others are saying. But you sort of mentioned this yourself. Now, look, nobody knows exactly what's going to happen. And you buy a bond and interest rates keep going higher for the next couple of years. You know, its market value is going to go down, right? So then hopefully you didn't buy a 30-year, hopefully you bought a 2-year and you can just hold it to maturity and get your principal back. Right. But what is kind of appealing about this is let's say you buy 2-year or shorter bonds in this environment is, so let's say the bears, the pessimists get proved wrong. And let's say, you know, early next year, bottoms in and stocks are back off to the races, right? Well, then in theory, especially if that's being caused by like a central bank pivot, yeah, right? Then rates should start coming down, right? So you're going to miss the bottom of the bounce, right? But you can always say, oh, okay, looks like things are shifting now. Since rates have come down, my debt market value is actually higher. I don't need to hold it to maturity anymore. I can sell it now for a profit and just put that liquidity straight into something else. So the cost is more opportunity cost as opposed to downside cost, which in a market like this where everything looks pretty shaky, that's not so bad.
No, it's not at all. And again, I'm not like, again, if you want to do it, it's fine. I'm not saying don't do it. The risk is that my point about the risk is that, yes, you know, in theory, what you just said is absolutely right. It's like, oh, right. The Fed's pivoted. I'm going to put money back into stocks. Okay. The Fed pivoted four times between 2009 and 2020, right? Between doing QE and not doing QE, Operation Twist, not Operation Twist, blah, blah, blah. We went through this multiple times. Then if what you said is true, and this is how investors think, then why is it that I'm getting clients coming into my office today that have been out of the market since 2009? Right. So the problem is that when you go through a bear market, and when we get into the real, we're not in a bear market yet. Again, you know, you're down 17-18%. When you're in a bear market, nobody wants to buy anything.
Right.
I mean, and so when this bear market bottoms, you're sitting in treasuries, you're going, I'm golden, man. I'm getting 4%. Who cares if the market runs up a little bit? It's going to come back down. It's going to go lower. Stocks are going to zero because Adam told me so. and that's going to be the mentality, right? I'm not touching stocks with a 10-foot pole, and stocks keep climbing and they keep climbing. And then you're in 2-year treasuries and they keep climbing. It's like, okay, well, I'll wait for them to come back down again. Now the Fed's pivoted. We're dropping QE. Stocks keep going up. Okay, well, stocks are overvalued. And it's that whole psychological trap, right, that we get into. And, you know, that'll be the case next time as well. A lot of, you know, and again, this is why I'm saying they should be a part of your allocation, but be careful just making it all of your allocation.
Oh, yeah. And look, that goes without saying.
That's all I'm saying.
Yeah. As you and I have said many, many times, you know, allocation and position diversification and position sizing are a massive part of the game.
Look, I'll give you a good example right now. I don't like structured notes for a whole variety of reasons, but I saw a really interesting one this past week. It was a 3-year note issued by Goldman Sachs, paid 6% interest, right? So that's not bad. And it has no downside risk. And if the S&P is up 22% or more over the next 3 years, I get a cap of 21%. So why wouldn't you want to own that? Well, the reason you don't want to own it is because over the next 3 years, the market's going to probably be up more than 21 or 22% from where the bottom of the market is, right?
Right.
And you're going to be going, how do I get out of this thing? And I can't get out of it. Now I'm locked into this thing that's yielding me 6% with a 21% cap over 3 years. You know, and that's what I'm saying is, like, you've always got to take these things that seem too good to be true up front and really understand what the dynamics are going to be 2 years from now, 3 years from now.
Yeah. All right. Very good. All right. Well, look, let's get to your trades for the week. What have you guys been up to?
That was pretty much it.
Okay. So, and understandable in a week like this, it probably is a hunk of week, right?
Well, yeah. We, you know, last week, you know, we added to some treasury bonds and we've been just, this process has been just kind of rebalancing portfolios, taking small positions here, just kind of reweighting, you know, our portfolio, still maintaining about 30% cash. That's our goal right now. Kind of just reweighting our duration mix and our bond portfolio as well between short and a little bit longer duration bonds. Because we do think that rates are kind of be bottoming here. If you take a look, for instance, at, you know, 10-year treasury rates, they're 3 standard deviations above their longer term moving averages right now. So again, interest rates are at a peak where the last time we were at this level, rates went back down to about 2.5%. So I think there's a really good opportunistic trade coming up on longer dated treasuries. And as the Fed continues to hike rates, they're going to break something at some point. And that's where rates will really start to fall, as you know, you see corporate yields going up as money kind of comes out of corporate risk and flows into treasury bonds for safety. We'll be in a recession at that point, may not be recognized yet, but it'll be clearly we're in a recession. You know, what FedEx is telling us is coming true. And most likely the Fed has broken something either economically or credit wise. And we won't be far away from the Fed starting to cut rates. Now, when they actually start cutting rates, that's going to even be better for long dated treasuries. So at that point, we're going to be fully invested long dated treasuries as soon as the Fed starts cutting rates.
Okay, great. All right. Well, look, got a few last things I want to get through. I guess let me ask this question first. Looking ahead in the near term, let's just say the rest of this year, I mean, stagflation really does seem to be the best word to sums up what we're going to be dealing with, right? Is the CPI print seems to add validation to the fact that our prediction of disinflation is going to happen, meaning inflation is going to come down. It's not going to go away. It's just not going to grow as slowly. But we did basically say, look, it's going to peak. I think we missed it by a month, but I think we proved out that we were likely correct. And as we said, it's probably going to take a while to moderate. And that's why the markets plunged so bad on Tuesday, was because the CPI print was higher than the market expected. It was still down a few tenths of a point from what it was, 8.5 in July and then 8.3 in August. Mm-hmm. But ruined the market's party of hoping that inflation was really getting under control quickly, right? At the same time, FedEx discussion we had, some of the other stats, the economy is slowing fast from all aspects. So, when you ask yourself, how do I invest for stagflation? What are some of the key tenets that you use to guide your decision making?
Well, a couple of things is that, first of all, we're talking about stagflation right now. The problem with stagflation is that it can become deflation pretty quickly.
Right. It doesn't last forever. Well, it can be brief.
It can be brief. And the question will be, and look, it's like driving down, you'll remember this, and there's a lot of our listeners that'll remember this, but there's, a lot of these younger millennials and Gen Xers, they won't. There was a time when you took a road trip, right? When I was growing up, we didn't fly anywhere. We drove everywhere. And Adam knows where I'm going with this. And you used to have this, you would have a map that you would basically have to unfold in the car. And the big challenge was—
You would have something called a map, yeah.
And the big challenge for the entire family was trying to fold the map back up, right? It never got folded back.
Yeah.
But, my mother, when we go on these road trips, right? Me and my brother in the back seat, my dad would drive, my mom was the navigator. And my mom was the worst navigator ever, right? We got lost all the time taking her classic scenic routes. But, she'd be looking at the map and she'd say, oh, honey, the turn was back there, mm-hmm. right? And so we have to stop, try to turn around, go back to the exit. But that's really what the reason I bring that up is imagine that, because that's the way the Fed is operating right now. The Fed is looking at this unemployment rate that is at 3.5, 3.7%, whatever it is. Jobless claims are very low right now. And they're going, hey, the economy is doing just fine because that economic data is telling us so. And we're hiking rates because we have inflation here, we've got employment there, and that says that we need to hike rates, bring down inflation, and employment is strong enough to hold all this together. So it'll all be fine. The problem is that unemployment is a big lagging indicator. So it's kind of like looking at that map. And then and the Fed hikes, as we talked about last week, they take 6 to 9 months to basically come in and impact the economy. So in March is where we're going to start to see that last 75 basis point rate hike, right? It's not going to show up till next year.
Right.
So by the time the Fed realizes that they've passed the exit, it's going to be too late. And that's why I'm saying, we may have stagflation for the next several months. And that's going to be this inflation with high employment, low economic growth. But that could very quickly morph into surging unemployment, collapsing economic growth, and a more deflationary environment as the Fed creates some type of monetary policy error. And I think that's the real risk going into 2020. I think we're okay for right now, but I think there's enough warning signs. You didn't mention the Atlanta Fed yet today.
I didn't.
Yeah.
Yeah. Introduce that.
Yeah. So, we were talking about how, quarter three was showing a 2.5% potential, uptick at the end, at the beginning of their reporting. It's now at 0.5%. So it's come down sharply just in the last week. It was at 1.5% just last week, came down to 0.5% growth this week, but it's quickly heading back towards zero. So, there's a real risk for the Fed that they go too far too quickly and they wind up breaking something. And this whole kind of stagflationary environment. And to answer your question, how do you invest in stagflation? Right now, energy stock, I'm writing about this weekend's newsletter. So again, go to realinvestmentadvice.com. The newsletter will be out on Saturday. But energy prices look like that they're very attractive level right now. And you know, we recently added to our oil and gas exposure. And because of what's happening in Europe with energy, what's happening and as we head into winter here in the United States with, you know, a lot of undersupply, I think there's a real opportunity for oil prices to climb at least back to $100 a barrel, if not more. That's going to bode well. I think that there's a real issue with economic growth. As that begins to slow, yields should start to come down because of slower economic growth. I think there's a good opportunity in longer dated treasuries. And that all kind of lines up well with that kind of stagflationary environment that we've got coming up. And then look at value stocks on the side. Again, we're talking about FedEx and others. There's some very interesting companies right now that are deep discount value companies yielding 4.5% yields. That make a very attractive portfolio position. They don't have a lot of downside risk at this point. Most of that's been wrung out. So it's kind of a way that you can pick up some yield in your portfolio, still have some equity exposure without taking on a lot of investment risk.
Okay. All right. Great. Well, look, I'm going to switch topics here as we begin to wrap this up. Hey, real quick, let me just ask, given everything you just laid out right there, for folks that are interested in kind of looking for specific investments to research, you know, after watching a video like this, you mentioned FedEx as a company that you're looking at. Are there any others right now that you kind of have your eye on? They might not be buys yet, but.
Yeah. And that's the problem with some of these companies. You gotta be a little bit, you know, picky about where you make entries or how you make entries. For Intel is very cheap. And that stock has been decimated. It continues to just break down into new lows. And you know, they just invested $20 or $30 billion into building a new semiconductor plant on a partnership basis. Of course, we've got the semiconductor bill that's coming down. It's going to provide more capital to semiconductor companies to build more domestic plants as well. We're seeing a lot of friendshoring with these companies also. But you know, there's it's an interesting potential that, you know, you got a stock trading at 4.5 to 5 times earnings on a trailing basis with, you know, a sub 1% price to sales ratio. I think of like a 4% yield right now. It's very attractive from a fundamental basis. Technically it sucks at the moment, so you don't touch it, but we are watching that one very carefully. If that thing starts to shape up technically, it could be a very interesting opportunity going forward.
All right. And let me ask this slightly differently. If you saw enough data that convinced you that the market bottom was in now, would Intel be near the top of your buy list?
Probably. Okay. FedEx would probably be higher. I'm a little bit skittish on Intel just because they have some legacy issues. But there's some really interesting companies like Analog Devices on the semiconductor side, AMD also on that side, Broadcom also. Those are still a little bit pricey on a fundamental basis, but from considering, you know, where the world is evolving in terms of artificial intelligence and, you know, how are companies going to displace a lot of this wage growth spiral that we've got going on now? They're going to do that through robotics and artificial intelligence and automation, and that's all semiconductors. So, you know, I think there's a real long runway for some of these companies that are down 40, 50% from their highs. If you can find the right entry point, I think you'll be able to like make a lot of money on that side.
Okay, great. All right. Well, look, you know, we sort of famously or infamously end these discussions with what I call a rant. I actually had sort of a communications specialist send me an email recently who said, hey, these are really valuable discussions. You shouldn't call them a rant because it allows people to dismiss what you're saying. Pardon me?
That's a rant's a good word.
Yeah, I know. And I've been trying to think of a different word. So anyways, if you're a viewer and you've got a better word we should use, let us know in the comment section and we'll hopefully get a gem that we'll use to rebrand our rants. But in the interim, we'll still call them rants. We were talking a little bit about this before we put on the camera, the recorder here, Lance. I guess where I'm going is we've had this new cultural phenomenon. It's actually not a new phenomenon at all. It's just got a new name, I guess, but called quiet quitting, right? Which is basically kind of just phoning it in at your job, right? And it's sort of being embraced right now by millennials and Gen Z. And, you know, I think they've given it this name, and like every generation, you feel like you've invented, you know, this concept, where of course every other generation just knows it by a different name. And quiet quitting, for those that don't know, it's literally just doing the minimum that you can get away with at work. Like you're just doing the minimum of what you're getting paid to do and nothing else, so that you can enjoy, you know, other balance in your life or make TikTok videos or whatever. And I'm not necessarily coming out here to slam the younger generations by any stretch, but to me, it's a reflection of how we've really devalued work in this country. And there's a whole bunch of different ways we could spin this, right? Where we've told a ton of people, you got to go get a college degree because that's what you need to do, you know, real work that's worthy. And, you know, we've really sort of vilified the trades over the past couple of decades, where of course that's the work that makes the world go round. And what's so funny right now is, or ironic right now is, people who went into trades 10, 20, 30 years ago, they're doing great. In many ways, they're doing a lot better than the part-time job guy or barista who's got their fancy, you know, philosophy or English or, you know, whatever, you know, modern culture and media degree from some expensive, pricey college, right? And of course, that's part of the tension when we were talking about the other week about loan forgiveness, is you've got these trade guys who didn't go to college, but somehow their tax dollars are financing, you know, the pricey diplomas these other guys got, while these guys had to go do actual real work, right? But as a business owner, you know, I have found it increasingly challenging, and I'd say it's been challenging for a long time, like a decade or more, but certainly recently, to find talent that really, you know, like values and appreciates having a job, right? And so I know you and I were just trading war stories before we came on here, but you know, I listen a lot to Mike Rowe. Do you ever listen to him?
Yeah.
Yeah, the guy who does Dirty Jobs and whatnot. He talks a lot about this a lot, where both as a society, we have, you know, kind of put in people's mind that work is something to be eschewed, right? It's a bad thing that we want to do less of in our lives. And also talks about how when you talk about what really brings people meaning in life, like at the end of the day, what really matters, yeah, love and your relationships are right at the top of the list. But another one too is like purpose and actually having the ability to create value and bring value forth into the world. And man, it just seems right now that I don't know if it's because we've had this jobs market where people just sort of had the ability to quit on a dime, knowing they're going to get three more offers if they ever want to leave what they're doing, or whether it's a cultural shift where, you know, maybe we've kind of coddled, you know, the younger generation so much with helicopter parenting that they just don't want to do anything that you know isn't amazingly cool all the time, and having to do sometimes just the brass tacks, blocking and tackling of regular work is too unsexy and beneath them. Again, I'm not trying to make this a generational thing. I'm just saying that, you know, it's something that I'm witnessing more and more and more. And I guess sort of what's making me think about this is, as we talk about going into a global recession, if that's indeed what happens, you and I have talked a lot about the risk of layoffs. That's something that's perennially on my mind. I've pushed my free, you know, layoff survival guide on folks, really trying to get folks out ahead of this. But I fear that a lot of people are very quickly going to realize what it's like to not have a job and what it's like to not bring that purpose. And I fear for a lot of people on what a rude awakening that's going to be, and for the economic hardship that's going to come along with it. I do wonder, and this might sound terrible to some people, but I do wonder if as a culture, maybe we need a little bit of that. Like maybe we need a little bit of a reminder of like the value just of work. How lucky we are to have it, because there's lots of countries out there where there's just massive amounts of people that are unemployed or don't have the ability to earn money to get above their station. And a lot of people, you know, live in poverty around the world. But also too, from just sort of that sense of meaning that I was talking about earlier. So it's a long, long context for this rant, but curious your thoughts on this.
Well, you know, a couple of things is, you know, you have to go back in history, you know, first of all, and remember, you know, kind of where we came from in a way. Is, you know, after World War I and, you know, after World War II in particular, you know, most of the world was devastated after World War II, and you know, most of Europe and Russia and Japan, et cetera, I mean, just completely bombed out. and had to basically start over. And the United States was kind of the last man standing in terms of manufacturing. And so all these soldiers that were involved in the war came back home. And all they had been doing was being a soldier, right? So they had to come home and jump right back into the labor force. And remember, during World War II, the women were in the manufacturing. Right. They were the ones producing the planes and the trains and everything. And so the men came over, took over those jobs, and they were menial. I shouldn't say menial. That's the wrong word. They were manual blue collar work, right? They were producing and manufacturing. They were working, you know, industrial lines, et cetera. And
building, constructing, also, manufacturing.
Right,
yeah.
They were building houses. And then of course, right into that, we get into the space race. And all of a sudden, you know, there's a whole future. We had the state fairs back then where they had the city of the future and they were talking about.
You mean the world's fairs, but yes, I know what you mean.
No, sorry, the world fairs. My apologies. But yeah, they were talking about the future of the world. We were all kind of focused on that future, and we were developing and innovating just terrific things, right? You know, the microwave and all kinds of, you know, the telephone and everything. And it was fantastic because, you know, everybody was pulling together and working in the same direction, and hard work was valued. And it wasn't, to your point, it wasn't like, oh, I need quality of family life and I need a work-life balance. Those words did not exist,
right.
With our parents. And then interestingly enough, you were saying, you know, they call it quiet quitting now. We called it slacking back then. So right. It's not new. It's just
they called it slacking when we were in the 80s. They called it lazy probably back in the 50s, right? Every generation had its own term, right?
It was interesting. I was just reading an article to my wife last night about there's a shortage of ADHD medicine right now because Teva Pharmaceuticals had an issue and they're not able to get enough produced apparently. And so there's these withdrawal symptoms from ADHD medication where you have lack of sleep, depression, and all this other kind of stuff. And, you know, and what's amazing is we're having a conversation where we have a whole generation of people basically addicted to ADHD medication so they can just focus on work. Now, when I was growing up, you've had ADHD, the medication for that was a knock upside the head. And it's like, say, concentrate, get back to work. Right.
Right. Right. But or you don't like your job, can't focus on your job. All right. There's the door, pal. Right.
Exactly. And suddenly you were able to focus.
Right.
But we've developed this whole generation, you know, we've got a pill for everything. And no matter what the issue is, you know, there's a problem. And I thought it was interesting, you know, recently when Elon Musk was, you know, talking about taking over Twitter, all the employees, you know, were upset because in their monthly, they have a day off every month just to basically kind of recenter themselves, right?
A mental health day, right?
And they were too stressed on their mental health day. And so, you know, this was really, you know, disrupting the whole flow. That's what the weekends are for, right? You know, you take the weekend off, you go de-stress, you get back to work on Monday. But to your point, though, look, we've come up with all of these excuses why, A, the workplace isn't fair, right? We all need to have more money. We have to have $15 an hour minimum wage. We need a living minimum wage, right? So if I'm working at McDonald's, you know, and I have three kids, I need a living wage to work. If you're at minimum wage, and you've got three kids and a family, there's the problem isn't the minimum wage. The problem is you, right? Because you are not moving yourself ahead in life, doing what you need to do to advance, because minimum wage salaries are starter positions for any company, right? It's Adam wants to come work for me. He's starting on minimum wage and I'm going to test him out. And if he's a good employee, I'm going to move him up the ranks. If he's not a good employee, he's going to be out the door. And I'm not out a lot of money, you know, paying him to test him out, right? So if you're stuck in a minimum wage job for 3, 4, 5, 10 years and you're having kids and raising a family in a minimum wage job, the problem's you. The problem's not the job. It's not the minimum wage.
Can I just make one comment on that, yeah, too, just to add to it? And first off, you know, we're not attacking in any way the people that are living in poverty and trying to get out of it. It is a tough hole. And, you know, watch the video I did with Linda Tirado, author of Bootstrap America, whatever. I mean, she lived and I think still lives this life, but wrote a book and speaks at universities about the plight of the working poor. It is a tough road. But one of the things that really makes me very concerned for these people is that for many years we have been giving an increasing incentive to industry to automate as fast as possible. And we are very quickly automating a lot of these entry-level jobs. So even the people who want to, quote, kind of do it right, Lance, who want to get the experience and get themselves, you know, rising in the career path, that first rung is getting removed for a lot of people because of all this.
But there's a reason for that. You know, again, we've talked about this before. Look, when you're demanding $15 an hour minimum wage, right? Okay, first of all, let's talk about what your minimum wage is. Your minimum wage is zero. It's the value that you bring to the job. If I walk into the door of a company and I say, sir, I will do any job you have and I will bust my ass for you to prove to you I'm a good employee. And he says, look, I'll pay you $5 an hour to wash dishes. Done. I'm not arguing with you, right. Whatever it is. You know, and the reason is when you start saying, hey, it's a $15 hour minimum wage, you know, or it's not just Adam at $15 an hour. Now my other employee that was at 15, I've got to move him up to 20 because right. He didn't want, you know, and it's this whole wage effect going up the ladder. But
right. Well, it's a form of price setting. And again, I'm not trying to be insensitive to people that need to earn enough to live, but it's a form of price setting. And we've railed many times, price setting in any context usually comes back to bite you.
It does. And this is why we now have friend sourcing, which is we were outsourcing before to unfriendly companies. So now countries, now we're going to friend source to, which is outsourcing to friendlier countries that don't have minimum wages and healthcare benefits and vacation and paid time off and parental leave and maternity leave and, you know,
right. And workers' comp and OSHA and just all the, I mean, what I was saying earlier is we are making it more and more expensive to just employ a human.
Right. Which is why you automate.
Which is why you automate. Exactly. And for the person starting out, that's not their fault, but you know, they're just like, I just want a job. But they're like, hey, we used to have a ton of fry cooks here, but now we have the McFry Master 2000 that does it all for us. So sorry, buddy, we don't need you. Right.
Yeah, no. And look, this is the trend of the future, but part of it is our own doing because we keep wanting, look, and I've told you this before, if you make $30,000 a year in the US, we think that's terrible. Right. I mean, it's like, that's horrible. You're below the poverty level. I don't know how you're getting by. That's just wrong. You shouldn't make that. You're in the top 1% of income earners worldwide. Think about that for a moment. You know, and this is also because in our culture, we, you know, there was this great TikTok video that's called Gen X Talks. And this young kid goes and talks to his Gen X father. And he goes in and he says, hey, dad, he says, how do you feel about the minimum wage? And he's like, you know, what do you mean? He says, well, how can a guy with, you know, three kids have a minimum wage job? Shouldn't he have a fair living standard? And he's like, why is a guy with three kids with minimum wage? Anyway, it goes back to that whole story. You know, we have created this narrative that we all deserve to live in 3-bedroom houses with a pool in the backyard. We all need to be able to drive, have 2 cars in our driveway. We all need the internet. We all need Apple iPhones for everybody in the household. We all need computers, you know, we've created this standard of living that is unsustainable by the economic environment that we currently have. And so because of that, that differential between the economic productivity levels and growth we have in the economy and this desired standard of living, we're all now going, hey, we need free stuff from the government. That makes it worse. That doesn't make it better.
Right. And what's so funny is you're saying, you know, we've developed a mindset that, you know, influences to try to really live far beyond our means. Mm-hmm. And we're looking for the government to help. Well, what does the government do? I mean, talk about living beyond your means. I mean, when's the last time we've ever had a balanced, you know, budget? When's the last time we haven't deficit spent in this country, right?
Well, and again, then who pays for that, right? So now the government's going to help. So the government's going to help everybody in the bottom 20% now be the middle 40%. Right.
But it's, I'm sorry to interrupt, but it's just a great analogy. It's like asking the town drunk to be the chair for Alcoholics Anonymous, right?
Exactly. But the taxpayer, but the guy that's making the money, he's going, well, why am I paying to subsidize all these people? I'm going to work less. I'm going to have some quality of life and have the government pay me, right? And that's why socialism never works. Socialism always drags everybody to the lowest rung because eventually the people at the top of the socialistic ladder get tired of paying for everybody else. And they go, well, screw it. I'm not going to do this anymore. I'm just going to go be on the dole with everybody else and not work and not produce and just go, you know, hang out at the pier and fish all day. And that's fine. But that's why socialistic economies always wind up with very low productivity rates over time.
All right. Well, and that's, you know, that's sort of where I was going with all this is worker productivity is like the lowest it's ever been at this point in time. Right. And there's a bunch of reasons for that. But this quiet quitting is increasingly cited as one reason for it. So, you know, it's not good for the individual. It's not good for society. It's not good for the economy. And like I said, I think, you know, sadly, in many ways, I think people might actually learn the lesson by losing the opportunity and only then realizing what a good opportunity they had, right? And it may take, you know, a long time before the economy recovers enough to start giving people the types of jobs again that they want. So anyways, we could clearly rant about this forever. But I'll let you have the last word on it.
Yeah, one thing though, just to wrap it. Look, you know, and we're not hitting on, you know, we're talking about generalizations, right? There's a lot of youth in this country that I have a couple of very young people that work in our office. They work hard. They show up every day. They do their job. And that's because they are surrounded by people that are working hard and doing their job and don't put up with crap, basically. So, you know, if you're not pulling your weight, you don't last very long in our organization. It just, you'll get run off pretty quick. You know, so part of it is the environment that you're in. And one of the worst things that happened in environments in terms of working was, you know, everybody working from home. There was too much lax time, not enough oversight, no camaraderie. Right. And again, when you're in a working environment where there are other people, you know, digging in and doing the job, it brings you up to that level. And, you know, it's very easy when you're on your own to kind of slack off and do this quiet quitting. But in the office, you don't get that opportunity to a great degree because your comrades will bring you up to a better level. If you have a good group of people you work with, they will bring you up to a better level. And also too, from the parental standpoint, you brought this up earlier, it is a parental issue. And this is why, you know, I've been making my kids, as soon as my kids turn 16, they start working. And the reason is I want them to know what it's like to work for minimum wage. Right. You know, they hated me for it. And they're like, my friends don't have to work and my friends don't have to pay for their car. And then my friends don't have to pay for their gas. And it's like, well, I'm sorry, you do. But my wife and I wanted them to know, you know, the issues of working for minimum wage and saying, this is all I can afford. And, you know, now they're in college and they're still working for minimum wage. They're doing DoorDash and they're waiting bars and tables and whatever they can do to make ends meet. But when they get out of college, they now know what they don't want, right? The whole goal of that lesson, and this is the value of minimum wage, and it teaches you very quickly two things. One is, you know, minimum wage allows you to go to work for a company and learn what you can and can't do, right? You can't go in and mouth off to your boss because they'll fire you, right?
Right.
So it teaches you how to start being a responsible employee. And if you realize, go into this $7.50 an hour job, whatever it is, minimum wage, and you do a good job, they're going to move you up the ladder pretty quickly. If you're quiet quitting the whole time, they're not going to move you up very quick. And again, you know, the other thing you're going to learn is what you don't want to do for a living, right? And the value of, if, you know, when I was growing up, you know, I don't know about you, Adam, but, you know, jobs for me growing up were mowing lawns, digging ditches, doing construction. You know, it was hot, it was sweaty, it was hard, it was...
Did we grow up in the same town?
Yeah, apparently. And, but, you know, but at the end of it, you know, you're like, I never want to do that again. And so you go to college, you get a degree and you work your way up in life. But, you know, we're the biggest disservice that we do to our children is to give them this idea that life is easy, and life is not easy. And we need to be preparing them for the challenges in life. Things are going to be hard. You're going to fail. You're going to fall down. And the biggest lesson that we can teach our kids are how to get up again and start over, because it's going to happen.
Well, absolutely. And, you know, we've talked about this a bit, about both the importance of failure as a teaching tool for your kids. And how to develop self-confidence. And we've talked a lot, I think even just last week or the week before, about, you know, sort of the secrets of families that are successful wealth builders. And it's really how they bring up the next generation and this sense of the struggle. Like, the struggle is the path to success, right? Yeah. They have to learn how to deal with adversity. If they don't, then you know, very few people that don't end up becoming long-term successful. All right. Well, look, we could clearly talk about this forever, so I'm going to have to wrap things up here. Real quick, folks, if you're not already aware of it, I do have a free resource out there that I'd love for anybody that feels like it might be relevant to them to go get. It's our layoff survival guide. Just go to wealthion.com/layoffs. And this is for anybody that works for a paycheck. And I highly recommend reading it now because it's got a lot of advice in there of things that you can do in advance of hard times coming to your industry so that you're hopefully one of the people that doesn't get fired during layoffs. But also if you do get laid off, it's got a lot of specific advice that you should follow like immediately once you get the pink slip to make sure that you're taking, you know, best care of your interests at a very stressful time. All right. So real quick, as we wrap up here, I want to remind folks of the conference. So if you haven't already, if you didn't already go earlier in this video and go register for it, now is the time to do that. Again, that's wealthion.com/conference. It's just a week away. And don't forget that the 15% price discount ends tonight. So literally go get it right now. All right. Well, look, if you enjoy these weekly market recaps the way that Lance and I and our spouses do, I'm going to include your wife this time, Lance. She helped with the setup. Lance set his setup this time, which is why I'm giving her a shout out. If you enjoy these, like I said, even a fraction of as much as we do, please do me a favor, hit the like button. And again, don't forget to click that red subscribe button below and that little bell icon right next to it. Lance, these are always great. They're so much fun. Everybody else, thanks so much for watching. Lance, I'll see you next week.
You got it.